I had my children on the floor. I was on my favourite blanket that my grandmother gave me on the floor like a cat.
And I realised in that moment the potential of what our bodies can really do as women.
Like, I could feel his head. I could do my own internal, like, yeah, his head, I could feel it.
I was in tears. I was just in tears and overwhelmed with gratitude.
Hi, and welcome to the Natural Birth Podcast, the podcast that is bringing embodied birth wisdom from women from all over the world sharing their natural birth stories. Don't forget to subscribe and download so that you can always have access to these empowering and positive natural birth stories.
Hi, my name is Anna, and I am the Natural Birth Podcast host. I'm a former midwife turned midwitch, and I now work with women worldwide, assisting them in having an empowering and natural birth experience and to truly claim their birth as a rite of passage. I offer one-on-one sessions and packages and online courses for conscious mamas who don't want to leave their birth up to chance. I also mentor current and aspiring birth workers in my Sacred Birth Worker Mentorship Program. If you want to know more about me and what I do in the world, then please visit me at thenaturalbirthcourse.com or connect with me on Instagram as The Natural Birth Podcast. Now, if you love this podcast, then please consider taking a moment right now and leave a review. They mean the world to me and is also your way of helping me reach more women around the world with these natural and empowering birth stories. Together, we are changing the birth narrative, one birth story at a time. Today on the Natural Birth Podcast, we have Nicole. Nicole is a mama of two from Australia. She is a gardener, performance artist, poet, and a multi-passionate birth nerd. She has lived on an off-grid intentional community in the forest by the sea for the last 20 years, raising her kids and cultivating a deep trust in birth and life. Her mission is to help women and families know what is possible in birth, why it matters, and to help them access a similarly blissful experience for themselves. Nicole knows in her bones that birth is powerful, as she was blessed with incredible undisturbed birth experiences. She draws on those memories and imprints every day of her mothering life. Nicole's lived experience of birth as beautiful, bountiful, and full of potential as a doorway to healing, along with her 15 years of work with birth imprints, confirms her beliefs in birth as a tool of conscious evolution. In today's episode, she will share about her two home births and about the beautiful practice of lotus birth, which means to not separate baby and the placenta until it naturally does so by itself days after birth. A spiritual practice she shares some of her own pearls of wisdom about. Curious about Nicole? Find her on Instagram as Birth Into Being.
There's so much depth and wisdom within it. It's so much more than just learning about physiologic birth. I feel like I've really gone to places that I didn't expect and really took a journey within myself.
I am really learning to be with women in this really deep and profound way.
It's the lush, yummy, yummy, yummy nourishing circles that we hold and the way that we share our hearts and see each other and witness each other as we journey and peel back the layers, the deep, deep layers of, you know, our own birth imprinting, our red thread lineage, like why it is we think and feel the way that we do.
Anna has brought absolute magic into my life in so many ways. And I can feel the change in my body, and I can see it in my life. and it's absolutely amazing.
I just kind of never wanted to end, which is cool because it doesn't have to. We're going to continue to meet monthly in our birth debrief sessions, and that gives my heart so much joy.
I'm really grateful for Anna. I'm really grateful for this program, for the sisterhood, for the relationships and the connections to women all over the world that I've got to experience, and I can't recommend the program enough.
Those were the voices of some of my current mentees in the Sacred Birth Worker Mentorship Program. I just wanted to remind any of you who have been interested in joining the next cohort that enrollment for January 2024 is now open, and there is an early bird offer this month of October where you can save $700 if you apply this month. That is $700 if you apply this month of October for the upcoming mentorship starting in January. Hope to see many of you gorgeous birth nerds, activists, mamas, and birth workers in there soon. This episode is sponsored by my favorite women's health supplement brand, Needed. I'm so grateful to finally have found a supplement brand that I trust and that I can recommend to my clients who are seeking assistance in fertility and conception, as well as for pregnancy and postpartum support. Most vitamins on the market are just expensive pee, and I love that Needed's products are bioavailable and come in forms that your body can easily absorb and at optimal levels, not just the bare minimum. I take Needed supplements myself. For example, in my morning cacao, I use their collagen from organic grass-fed cows, as well as their immune-supporting powder, including elderberry, zinc, and pre- and postbiotic powder. It's delicious, and I feel amazing using it. If you want to optimize your health, then I invite you to pop on over to thisisneeded.com via the link in the show notes, which gives you automatic discounts on their website with the coupon code TheNaturalBirthPodcast. Hi, Nicole, and welcome to The Natural Birth Podcast. How are you today?
Wonderful, thank you.
Lovely to have another Australian on. I love speaking to mamas from Australia. I do have a love for that country and will always do. So today we're going to talk about the births of your babies who are now teenagers, which is a lot of the times women come on kind of the same year they've given birth. Sometimes a lot of women actually today, they come on just weeks after birth because they're so excited to come on the podcast and share after listening for years. So this is going to be different. You're going to have to rewind your memory and pick those super beautiful details around your birth stories. And we're going to start with you consciously conceiving your baba. So let's begin there. Wherever you want to start off, Nicole, you're welcome to do so now.
So I'm just casting the net back into those days where my partner and I were... We'd moved out of the city together and we'd moved up the coast, which, you know, as you would know, in Australia, it's quite a rite of passage, you know, head north. And so we'd done that and we'd been there for some time and all the people around us, we'd landed on a beautiful community and all the people around us were asking us, when are you going to have a baby? But for us, our relationship still felt quite fresh. You know, we were less than 2 years when we conceived. So we were in that place of kind of, let's see. But we were living in this magical, magical place in the forest by the sea and, you know, just so much beauty around us and all the gorgeous children that we were interacting with was definitely, yeah, we sort of reached that point of just not being able to sort of be together at all, let alone intimately, without having the baby talk coming up, you know, and it was just conscious, constantly there between us, like a, you know, if we imagine that a soul is choosing to come in or not, it was like he was there waiting for us to just say yes. So eventually one idyllic day, we actually made love on the beach and boom, there he was, little darling. And we had a gorgeous pregnancy.
I was, you know, surrounded by women who live close to the land and close to the earth. They were, you know, all interested in alternative health, and a lot of them had had home births. So it kind of was like all conversations kind of led to the same midwife, who was somebody who lived out in the valley. We were on the coast and she was in up past the Bellinger Valley. I met with her and it was an instant yes. There were actually numerous midwives to choose from back then, not like now. And but Joey was just an instant yes. You know, she was a fair bit older than me, so there was that kind of, you know, maternal projection going on. And it felt, you know, it just felt really right. She had plenty of experience. She had a few students working underneath her. And so one of them would be my doula, who is still a wonderful friend today. And yeah, that was the choice. So every, you know, every month, I guess, we would travel out to the valley and have cups of tea and, you know, listen to the baby's heartbeat, whatever. There was no interventions of any kind. I did try initially to have one foot in each camp. So I saw the local doctor just to sort of like, you know, let him know that I was pregnant and just to kind of like be on the books as a pregnant woman. I did go to the Women's Health Center in the local, you know, the bigger town close to us, and one of the nurses there was absolutely revolting when I asked, you know, well, what if I have a home birth, but, you know, something, if I need to transfer, what's the protocol? And she, you know, I was young, obviously, and yeah, she was revolting. And said, you know, if you're ripped from head to toe and bleeding to death, well, the doctors will accept you, but they don't really want to. And it was like,
oh my God. Wow.
You know,
well, so, unfortunately, yeah. This attitude still remains, but, you know, amongst a lot of the hospital kind of personnel.
But to say that to a, yeah, to say that to a first time young mother, you know, young woman presenting like full of questions and excitement was kind of disgusting.
Yeah.
So then we, you know, abandoned the Women's Health Center and any thoughts of, you know, liaising with the hospital, and just saw the midwife and saw this country doctor. That sort of didn't go so well either, because he asked me to do certain tests and I said no to absolutely everything except the diabetes, the gestational diabetes test.
Okay. Why did you choose that one?
I just thought that it's like it's not taking bloods. It's not, you know, it's not an ultrasound. It's just, you know, I'll just go without a meal and, you know. And then, of course, once I did it, I realized actually it is quite invasive, you know, to starve yourself for 8 hours when you're pregnant.
Yeah.
And then drink that horrible sugary drink.
Yeah. And it's actually, if you're a low risk woman, and it's important for people to know, because everyone who's listening to this podcast, they're from all over the world. So different countries have different policies. So, in some countries, like here in Sweden, you don't do the diabetes test if you're not a high risk woman or pregnancy. Whereas in Australia, it's offered to all women. And it's actually one of the ones I would caution women to, if you're not, you know, if you're not actually at risk, it's very controversial test, and it's actually probably one I would have avoided if I were you. But of course, you know, you were like, oh, let's pick one that's not invasive. But it's actually, it can definitely put you, you know, spiraling down a pathway if you're just like a millimeter over what that test says is normal. You're classified as gestational diabetes, even though you might be a super healthy woman, there's no problem with you and your baby, but you're then, you know, in such a spiral with doctors and dietitians and all of it.
Yes.
And maybe, whole, you know, you're not allowed, with quotation marks, to even birth at home, you know, in some places. So.
Yeah. Well, that definitely happened. The black hole opened up.
Oh, no.
No, the black hole of insecurity and and of questioning everything. But again, I was really well held by my midwife and by one of her students who just supplied me with an incredible amount of totally relevant information. So instead of having to go on that whole trajectory myself, they showed me a bunch of information that said, you know, don't worry about it. And exactly what you've said, like, why do that test? You know, like I was like a very young woman completely in my prime, you know, there was no reason. But like I said, I just did it to kind of satisfy him because I was trying to play both games, you know, like I was trying to just, you know, cover my ass more or less and just have some contact with a doctor. He was also the local obstetrician at the in this small town. And I just thought, oh, it's good if he knows that I'm pregnant and I'm on the books. You know, and he wasn't trying to pressure me one way or the other, except for doing these tests. So anyway, it was part of the journey of kind of, you know, really claiming that autonomy. Cause I think when you're so young, you know, you don't really realize what you're giving away when you kind of step into that world. And that experience really helped me to see that, that, wow, you know, if I was a different person and if I wasn't supported the way that I am, I could totally be drawn into this black hole. So anyway, we got through that. Probably about 7 months into the pregnancy, I actually got very sick with meningitis as well. And that was also like part of the journey of just really helping me to sort of cancel everything that I was doing in my life. I was very active in the community. I was always cooking and doing lots of things for other people. I was gardening a lot. And, you know, whilst all of that's fantastic, particularly the work, you know, for group gatherings and things like that, like it's just, it was time for it to stop. And this illness made it stop. I did end up in hospital for a night or two. And I did also end up having to, you know, really claim my autonomy and my decision-making prowess in that environment. There was one of the doctors, you know, they were trying to keep me under observation to see whether I had viral or bacterial meningitis. And I can't remember which is which, but I ended up having the non-dangerous kind. But that to check it, they wanted to do a lumbar puncture, which is where they take, you know, fluid from your spine. And I was like, you know, I'm sort of 7 months pregnant. That's still a little bit too early for the baby to come. I don't think I'm going to put my body under that stress. You know, it was more than enough that I was in hospital. And it was just because I'd lost too much fluids or something, you know, like I had, you know, pumping headache and couldn't bear the light, all that sort of business. So we got through that. Again, I always meant to complain to the AMA, which is the Australian Medical Association, about that doctor and his insistence and his manner around, you know, insisting that I have that test. But it was really, you know, in retrospect, you look at those events and go, oh, that's, you know, that was almost like part of the heroine's journey of like claiming your authority, you know, not just once, but twice. And then, you know, and it really, again, in retrospect, now with the children so old, I can really see how all of those experiences completely informed my mothering and, you know, allowed me to find the strength that I needed, not just for birth, but for parenting. So, yeah.
Beautiful. So let's dive on into your birth story now. That's why we're here. Do you want to take us back to, did you have any early signs of labor approaching for you, or did it just start with a bang? How did it start for you?
With lots of waiting. I was a little bit, you know, over what we were expecting. So I had my birth space all beautifully set up. I'd had women's gathering in there and lots of song. And so my kids were born in a teepee. We didn't have a house at the time. We were living in a caravan in a sort of extended camp situation, waiting to build our house. And so we had the teepee all set up with a beautiful big bathtub and the fireplace and everything. And we were just kind of like waiting and then still waiting. In the end, I was very keen and, you know, for things to begin. And I'd stopped riding my bike to the beach. I'd stopped doing everything, you know, for months since the meningitis. I was really like, come on, baby. And it was just a gradual, very, very sort of gradual kind of, you know, the Braxton Hicks extending and extending. And then, you know, kind of like, is this it? Oh, yeah, I think this is it. And I didn't have my waters break until I was already quite progressed in labor and I was in the bath. So there was no like big gush. There was a little bit of a show and that was kind of cool to know, okay, yep, we're on. We're started. And I had my partner, the midwife, who we probably called too early, but she lived 40 odd minutes away. So we were like, let's call her. And she arrived and luckily one of the other women. So then I had a friend and the midwife's student who was a doula. So I had the four of them and me. And it was kind of like, things slowed down because I was feeling quite watched, you know. Yeah. And thankfully, my friend who was attending the birth had brought her van up to the house. So we put the midwife to sleep in the van. We put the doula to sleep in the caravan. Mm-hmm. I think my friend just sort of got a blanket and went and laid down outside. And my partner and I just kind of chilled inside the teepee and, you know, wait. And it was really textbook, you know, all the different phases of surrender, of, you know, really going into that space of, you know, if every other woman throughout history, or, you know, not every, but if the whole lineage of women before me has done this, then there's absolutely no reason that I can't do it too. Mm. And also those moments of surrender where you say, okay, I'll give it everything I've got. And if it means that I have to leave so that the baby survives, I'm ready. You know, it was really, I mean, that was obviously much later in the labor, but it was really, you know, just a completely powerful rite of passage really, of going through those milestones.
I really love that you mentioned that, because, you know, that you went to that point, and so many women do, not everyone does, but, you know, that thought of like, okay, so if I need to fully surrender my life for this baby's life right now, I'm ready to do so. And that's the ultimate mother sacrifice, isn't it? Like the love of a mother and to fully embrace your new role, especially the first time, you know, the rite of passage from maiden to mother. And for you, that thought came. And I think that's beautiful and so true. And it's like, it's almost supposed to happen. You know, you're supposed to fully let your old self die. And that almost ego death that happens then in that birth process to come out and then fully be mother for this new life that so desperately needs everything from you, fully dependent on you. It's like nature wants you to hit that point of like fully surrender yourself to the death of the maiden, the birth of the mother.
Yeah. Well, there were so many moments, you know, like, so I mentioned connecting with the women behind me, you know, where you have these kind of epiphanies in a, you know, in a protracted labor. I'm sure it's different if it's really short, which my second was very short and we didn't have much time to think at all. But, you know, where you have these epiphanies of like, you know, I'm just like every woman. There's nothing special about me, that my body can't do what every other woman's body has done. This moment of complete surrender. And then also like when you are through the birth and you're reflecting back and you think, gosh, and it's so cliched, so many women say it, but it's like primarily true that if I can do that, then I can do anything. And I felt like, you know, especially in those early years where you're adjusting to being a mum and you like stretched beyond any capacity that you never even dreamed of, you know, like in terms of what it takes to constantly keep giving, to constantly keep showing up, even when you're sleep deprived and even when, you know, you haven't had a shower for days or whatever it is that is stretching you, to really hold that thought of like, I gave my life for this child. I'm ready. I can do this. I can do anything. You know, it's a very strong imprint, and it absolutely helped me throughout the whole journey and still helps me today, you know, because these teenage years are not so easy either.
I really can echo that. So many women on this podcast and so many women that I've, you know, attended their births and walked alongside them say the exact same. And I see a very strong correlation from that deep imprinting and that deep reward that you somehow get through moving through physiological birth and the hardship of that. Like, it's hard, whether it's a short or a long one, whatever kind of birth you have, but doing it physiologically, having those hormones that build in your body, that especially happens throughout a long ordeal, like, you know, very long labor, the more of these hormones you actually build in your body, the kind of stronger it seems to be, this imprint that you just spoke of, and like the deep embodied understanding that I can do anything, so I can meet anything now I birthed.
I've done a fair bit of research on oxytocin because I'm fascinated by it, and you know, I actually, it was with Michel Audent that I first heard that, it's because I was asking him about testing for the presence of oxytocin in the body. And he, you know, was just nerding out on things. And he said, well, you know, it's a pulsing hormone. It pulses. It's not like it's a continuous kind of presence. It's a pulsing thing. And you can really feel that, like when you're breastfeeding and you have a letdown, which is when the breast milk spontaneously and starts to leave your breasts, you know, like when the baby is crying in another room, or, you know, if the baby is just about to wake up, so you will feel it in your breasts, you know, and feel that milk start to come in. And so that really rings true for me, what you say, that you know, with a long labor, you get so many of these pulses and so much of this kind of long enduring endorphins. And I think that also would contribute to that sense of like, it's okay for me to leave. I feel so much love and so much surrender, and I am ready now to do anything for this baby to emerge safely. And, you know, conceptually that comes up as, you know, I'll give my life. And, you know, and it all sounds kind of dramatic, but it's like that. It's kind of epic.
It's deep. Yeah. It's spiritual. It's so much beyond the physical event of birth. And that is what, you know, I'm hoping with all these stories in this podcast and all the work that I'm doing, that we can start to change the birth narrative around the world. If women listen to your story, hear this, just this piece that you just shared, and really drink it in, really understand the magnitude of like what it is to go through a natural physiological birth, I don't think that so many would be so afraid that they are today of this journey, you know.
Well, there's, you know, so many rewards as well, because, you know, when I think back to like the absolute bliss, you know, when after, you know, going through a transition, that whole, again, very cliched, traditional kind of gateway of I can't do this, I'm giving up, that's it. And then moving into the pushing stage, roaring, you know, like completely disinhibited. And when he finally emerged, just this instant bliss, like all physical sensation that had been so huge just moments before was completely gone in the face of this, you know, gorgeous, perfect little baby boy. So he was born in water. So inside my teepee, it was quite a large teepee, I had a double bed, a fireplace with a fire happening. It was early spring, and a big clamshell bath that was full of water. And then, of course, the toilet bucket and the little altar that we had, where I had, you know, pictures of my grandparents and different deities that I was calling on for strength. And in the bars of the teepee, I had pictures of women from all different cultures around the world that I was also drawing on to give myself that reminder, that visual reminder of just how many women had gone before me. And yeah, so after he came out, and we did a lotus birth, so we had birth placenta, had it floating in the bath with us in a back, you know, sort of bowl thing. Yeah, and then we were just very nicely tucked into bed by the midwife, you know, after very brief checking and everything. She, you know, all that just happened without me really focusing on it. Yeah, and I got tucked into bed and fed beetroot soup. So blood building, you know, would have had like bone broth base, but it was beetroot soup, very, very thick, and like a Russian meal, you know. Mm. There is a Russian name for beetroot soup. Mm. And the bliss that I felt, like we have one photograph, just one photograph of us snuggling into bed with this tiny little baby. Yeah, it's one of the most valuable and important memories of my life.
Mm.
It's gone on to inform me in so many ways. And yeah, and my son is now a very watery guy. He is in the ocean every day. And I sort of do that with a roll of the eyes, because, you know, it's like almost a hassle sometimes, you know, that he has to get in his surf or his dive or... Yeah, but it's a beautiful part of his story to know that he emerged in the water, and he's continued to live in the water nearly every day.
Beautiful. So how long was this first birth of yours?
22 hours.
22 hours from the first kind of niggle, or where are you counting?
Yeah. From the first point where I went, okay, yeah, this is it.
Yeah,
this is more than Braxton Hicks. I'd been in Braxton Hicks for days, you know, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, so 22 hours, and, yeah, it felt right that it was that length of time, because, as I've mentioned, all these gateways, you know, that I had to move through, and, yeah, and there was absolutely no time pressure or anything, you know, because I had the two friends, that, you know, the one that was the student midwife and doula, and the other who was a friend who was already a mother herself and had been at other births, and so they were able to rotate the practical things that needed to be done in a teepee, because, you know, we had to get firewood, the kitchen was a fair, you know, at least 10 meters away, so, you know, things were going backwards and forwards. You know, the refreshing of the hot water in the bathtub. So those two were on top of all the practical things. My partner was my rock by my side, and the midwife, being a little bit older, yeah, just like I said, when she first got there and things had slowed down, she went to bed. Just wake me up in a few hours. Yeah, so it didn't feel like, you know, the team was exhausted. It didn't feel like I was exhausted. It felt like just the right period of time to go through those gateways. Yeah, and to experience all the different stages of labor.
Mm. Yeah, and it's so typical to have a bit of a longer, well, that's just kind of a normal length, really, to have.
Are you ready to join me and others in being a part of the movement of the reclaiming of birth as a rite of passage and as a woman's sacred business? I'm calling you who recognizes birth as a sacred portal and a life-altering event worthy of honoring and safeguarding. You who want to walk alongside women through her rite of passage from maiden to mother and provide a safe, sacred, and physiological birth space. Here's your invitation to join me and other women from around the world in the Sacred Birthworker Mentorship Program, becoming a sacred birth advocate and space holder, the Beyond a Doula training, starting in January 2024. It's a full year's container of learning, embodying, and deepening into a true space holder and sacred advocate for a woman's rite of passage of birth. By weaving ancient and modern knowledge of her story, women's wisdom, physiological birth skills, and the art of sacred space holding, as well as diving into the variations of normal, medicalized birth, birth advocacy within the current unnatural maternity system, and so much more. This program is unique to its kind in its depth and how deep we go, and also that I offer you one-on-one mentoring with me personally assisting you in becoming the clear channel and the best space holder that you can be. You will be so held and so nurtured and so supported for a whole year inside our worldwide online community as you learn and embody the teachings and skills and start sharing your gifts with the world. If your intuition is ringing clear as you receive this invitation, find out more and apply at thenaturalbirthcourse.com or via the link in the show notes.
Let's dive on into your second then. How long did you wait until you decided, or did you decide, or she or he?
No. Yeah, she snuck in. Yeah, she snuck in. It was like this, you know, I was quite, you know, it was all very new to me. And we were practicing elimination communication with my son, you know, pretty much from birth. And I wasn't ready as such. And was quite like, you know, our relationship was going through lots of changes, you know, shifting to accommodate having a baby. So we were being quite cautious and using condoms because I was still breastfeeding and I was never taking the pill anyway. But we were, you know, I was still breastfeeding, so my period wasn't reliable in any sense. So we were mostly using condoms for making love. But then twice we had unprotected sex. And the second time I remember lying back afterwards and thinking, that was probably a bit silly. Gee, I wonder, could I be a mum of two? I think, and that moment, you know, some little doorway in my mind opened and boom, in she came.
And
that pregnancy was very different because it was the second time around, and I'd had everything, even though I had those illnesses that I spoke of, I felt very confident. I had a lot of confidence in my body back then. I probably still do. And yeah, we went traveling. So we had saved a fair bit of money to build a house. And when we found out that we were having a second child, we went, okay, let's go to India. Because, you know, we won't get to go for a while. So we went to Sri Lanka, and then for my husband to surf, my partner, to surf in a spot that he'd always wanted to go to.
And then we went up to North India for me to sit with a teacher that I'd sat with previously, because we were just like, you know, we're going to be a family of four. We're probably not going to go anywhere much, you know, like we better do this now. So we blew our savings and went on this journey. Our little son was two. And in fact, he was just under two, because we also thought in Australia, you don't pay for children under two to travel by plane. So we thought, oh, we'll get him, you know, on the plane for free. Yeah, so he was just under two when we left. He was two and a half when she was born. Yeah, we had a great trip. It wasn't, I was probably a bit too confident in my body, because, of course, I got what they call Delhi belly, which is, you know, like jadia, basically. And that wasn't great. And I did feel like, whoa, am I being a bit irresponsible here, you know? Mm. And so from that point on, I was like, okay, only good hotels, nothing cheap, you know, everything has to be really clean. I had to get really strict about everything that I was eating. It was the classic thing. I'd had a salad.
Yeah.
Because I was in a restaurant where I saw someone else eating a salad, and I thought, oh, that looks so good.
Not in India. So I'm guessing you were past the first trimester, though. You were in your second trimester when you went, which is a bit more safer. But just for anyone listening, like actually getting like food poisoning or you know, which Delhi belly really is, can cause miscarriage. So yeah, that would have been a bit scary for you for sure to get that.
It was. So I tightened up and got a bit more strict with myself about, you know, what I was doing. Yeah, we continued the travels. It was interesting because in India, I guess because there is more risk around infant mortality, you know, infant mortality or baby mortality, there's a lot more miscarriage than what we have. And so it's considered quite bad luck for a pregnant woman to be wandering around, and certainly not like with a backpack and a kid. And so that got a bit freaky as I progressed in the pregnancy. It was like shopkeepers didn't really want me to be their first customer of the day, which is, you know, the first customer of the day is meant to be very auspicious, and you need to spend money. You can't go to a shop and just look if you're the first customer. They'll really put it on you, like, but you're the first customer. You must buy. And, yeah, it could be a ploy, but there's also a lot of superstition.
Yeah, for sure.
And anyway, long story short, I decided that I would like to come home early. So we went to Delhi, and you know, I took my son to the zoo every day while my partner went to the Qantas office and tried to get our tickets changed. And it took a lot of negotiating, but he did manage to get the tickets changed. And by this stage, I was like, just, you know, let's just pay whatever we need to pay. I want to go home. I don't want to go back to Sri Lanka. You know, it's giving me the heebie-jeebies, all these people thinking I'm bad luck. I was obviously getting heavier, and just like, I just want to be on our beach where I can literally walk naked through the surf dribbling. I didn't want to, like, you know, I just wanted the safety of home. And yeah, we got our flights home, and when we landed back in Brisbane, we got the terrible news that the tsunami had hit Sri Lanka, which was that was in 2005. And that was exactly the place, the village where we were going to be staying if I hadn't insisted on coming home, was wiped out completely. So
that's crazy.
Yeah.
I actually was in Thailand when that happened with my whole family and extended family. And we had a similar story. We were supposed to be where the tsunami hit, but my beautiful grandfather insisted on this other place on the other side of the country. And we weren't at all affected, but close call. Yeah. Wow.
that was extremely fortunate for us. It's very sad for everybody else that was hit so badly by that tsunami. And we did go on to do a lot of fundraising and sent a lot of money back to that village as a way of kind of alleviating that survivor guilt, I guess. You know, and giving back to a situation that, you know, could just have easily have been us. So, and, you know, we did like a waterfront bungalow. So, you know, we would have been right there. And so my darling daughter, we got home. I had the same midwife. I hadn't seen her much because I'd been traveling. So we had a few visits and you know, reconnection times before the baby came along. But yeah, having a toddler meant everything was different, and I wasn't getting any of the opportunities for kind of soul searching. There was no journaling. You know, I do have I kept beautiful books with love letters to both children. And I did have one, but it has very few entries in comparison to my son's book, which is like pages of, you know, hopes and aspirations and thoughts and processes around bringing him through. But for my daughter, of course, there's like just a few entries. And one of them was a picture I drew of a big giantess with the earth as her belly, and you know, it was just like it was almost like I was winging it, you know, in terms of preparation for the second one. I just thought, something's gonna happen, I'm gonna have a baby, you know. Yeah. I don't really need to go into it too much. I'd done so much reading the first time around. This time was much more about just grabbing any moment that I could to really connect in with my body. And yeah, and she came in 1 hour and 20 minutes.
Wow. That's a big difference from 21 hours, isn't it?
Yeah.
So yeah. Did you tell us about that? Take us back to, did you get any early signs, or was it just bang?
It was just, you know, yeah, we're building up, you know, we're getting close, we're Braxton Hicksing through the night, you know, losing a bit of sleep in the night. And then it was a Tuesday afternoon, and I was kind of like, you know, again in that waiting phase. And I was watering the garden and everything, and I felt a few contractions, and I was like, this could be it. I went to the teepee and relaxed, meditated a bit, you know, just chilled. I'd sent my son down to the neighbor's house. So he took himself, actually, it was only two houses. So he sent himself down to the neighbor's house where he'd been spending quite a bit of time. He really enjoyed their chickens. So I said to him, go and see what the chickens are doing. And he did, and he didn't come back for some time. Somebody must have rung them to say, you know, she's gone into labor, because I, at some point after meditating and everything, I went to the toilet, and we were living on the land. We had a composting toilet, so it's actually a squat toilet, and I could barely walk back. So, you know, the toilet was probably 25 meters away from the teepee. But I remember like numerous times, it was the longest walk back from the toilet, because numerous times I was on my hands and knees on the ground going, ooh, ooh.
Wow.
Yeah. So I made it back into the birth space, and there was no time to fill the tub. And it was all there, ready, but no time to fill the tub.
And was your partner just with you, or did he notice, or yeah, were you just by yourself? Yeah.
No, he was with me. And he called the midwife, you know, somewhere in it, he called the midwife, when, you know, when he realized, okay, we're quite far along, because it didn't make sense given what we'd experienced last time being so long. You know, we both were like, this is strong, but we can't possibly be close. But we were. And at some point I said to him, go and get the water situation sorted and fill up the tub. So I was by myself for a good period of time because there was something wrong with the water. He had to go down to the dam and pump it. He was gone for a good half hour. And then when he came back up, I sent him again to go and tell the neighbours to stop drumming. Somebody was drumming and it was really annoying and really taking me out of my, you know, concentration for each contraction. So he went and did that job as well. And then he came back. My friend had arrived and I was on my hands and knees and I could feel the head, but it was still in the sack. So it was quite spongy. And I was like, what's that? You know, so I told her, you know, have a look. Tell me what that is. You know, this was the friend, not the birth support student midwife, just the friend who, you know, and she made a bit of a boo-boo and said, I think it's the placenta.
Oh,
so
God.
Then I freaked out. Yeah. I freaked out completely. And it was not the placenta. It was just that the baby was still in the sack. So the sack was kind of bulging out of my yoni.
Yeah.
And I had a very spiritual mantra going on towards the end. I'm not sure if you you have a language warning on your podcasts.
No.
Should I say it?
Absolutely.
It was oh my fucking God. Oh my fucking God. Oh my fucking God. Which is really unusual for me because I'm not so into God. You know, I'm much more likely to call on a goddess.
Yeah.
So, but I just got stuck on that. And when the midwife arrived, she came in, just took one look and said, okay, the next contraction's going to be it. Just give it what you've got. And until this point, until she had arrived and, you know, with my friend saying the placenta, I'd just been breathing. Mm. There was no pushing. I was just, you know, through every contraction, just kind of riding it and not wanting to bring any of my own energy. And then when the midwife said, you know, well, this next contraction probably is going to bring the baby out, you know, you can give it what you've got. And that was such a shock that I didn't really. And so it was like it all just happened of its own accord, really. Mm. And then again, you know, I'm a researcher, so I went looking for answers after the birth. And the best thing that I could come up with was the fetal ejection reflex, you know, where the body spontaneously releases the baby because, you know, we don't necessarily need all that coaching and
no.
Push, push, push.
Oh, no, we definitely don't. No.
Mm.
When physiology is upheld, most of the time the body takes over and births your baby. It's when it's disturbed, either if you have a medicalized birth, you're on your back, you know, you maybe have an epidural or something like that. Yeah, that's a different scenario. Then you do have to do something to push your baby out. But not if you're having a natural physiological birth where you're on all fours and you're breathing. Like if that baby is in the right position, it will find its way out very quickly. Yeah, especially second time around.
Yeah, and it was really fascinating to me because, again, like I said, I had not done lots of preparation. I hadn't had a lot of space to tune into the baby and, you know, nowhere near like the first time because I was always caring for a two-year-old. So It really felt like I'm just going to go into a tunnel and I'm going to come out with a baby in my hands. You know, like it just felt like, okay, I know my body can do it. I'm good. Let's do it. You know, and it was amazing, amazing. And, you know, and I think about her birth story. I'm just looking at her picture on the wall here. When I think about her birth story, it absolutely reflects who she is. You know, she's an absolute dynamo. Mm. So, and nothing is slow or fluffy with this girl. She's like,
she's fire. It's interesting how, you know, babies show you what kind of mother they need, you know, and their personality. And literally, even as babies, they have this strong personality. all babies are different. They really have their unique character from the get-go. Mm. So she shoots out. Do you catch her, or you're on all four? So does the midwife catch her then?
Yeah, I actually don't remember. It must have been the midwife, because I know that it wasn't my partner. He did, you know, I think he was with me. The waters broke as she emerged, you know, at the same time as she catapulted out. Yeah, and I was as high as a kite, like, you know, out of my skin with excitement. It was absolutely like, you know, heaps of endorphins, heaps of oxytocin, but also heaps of adrenaline. Like, I was excited. And I was standing up and things like that, you know, not immediately. I settled back on some cushions and things with her in my arms, and I still had the placenta inside. And my son came back from the neighbor's house and came in and met her and everything. And then I was kind of like, whoa, starting to feel a bit, okay, I need some more focus and birth the placenta. Because my son had come back in with his childhood friend as well, who was just a couple of years older. So these two little boys were there, like, you know, admiring the baby and everything, and that I still had the placenta inside. So I booted the boys out of the teepee and focused on birthing the placenta. But after the placenta was born, I was on my feet and everything, and yeah, the midwife was like really urging me, like, sit down, Nicole, lie down, you know. And then at one point I got up again, and she got really strict with me and said, lie down, you know, like, what are you doing? Chill out. You need to relax.
Yeah.
You know, because I was like, I was so high. It was just this, yeah. Anyway, so I got that the second time, and I chilled out. And yeah, and I distinctly remember that she too was absolutely perfect. But, you know, I remember just being like, oh, everything about her was just perfect, translucent skin and everything. But then when I look at the photo, she's actually like red and blotchy, and, you know, with a few pimply things and everything. But I remember feeling how perfect she was. You know, so yeah, it was gorgeous.
So how did it go with the placenta? When did you birth the placenta? Did it take a while?
Yeah, it did. It did. It took concentration and, you know, just a tiny little bit of traction. It took getting up into a squat as well, because I was sitting. You know, with her in my arms and sort of reclining and kind of dealing with feelings like contractions. But I had to pass the baby to someone else and, you know, get up and squat properly to let it out. And, yeah, you know, with both babies, it was actually amazing feeling the placenta come out. After a bony head, a placenta is like a caress.
That's a good way of seeing it.
Like a, you know, a firm sort of caress, a plop, you know, nothing. Yeah. And it was a relief. I remember it being a relief both times, like, okay, whew, we're done.
Yeah. And sometimes when you've had a really short, quick, powerful birth like that, sometimes the placenta takes a while because you're in that kind of adrenaline surge still. You're in that also maybe a little bit of a shock that it went so fast. And so, just like the midwife said, like, relax, like, you need to go into that relaxation again for the placenta to be, you know, allowed by your body potentially to be let go of, right? So it makes sense that it took a bit longer. So did you do a lotus birth for her as well?
I did, but with my son, we had left the cord to dry up and come off of its own accord. With my daughter, she had the placenta attached for 24 hours, and then so we lived it and still have a house in the Australian bush, and there was a goanna hanging around. And for those that don't know, a goanna is a big lizard, and they're they love meat, and they particularly love rotten meat. So when they kill a chicken or something, they usually leave it for a few hours out in the sun so that it gets nice and tasty. So this goanna was hanging around our teepee. And, you know, a teepee doesn't, it's not securely attached to the ground. There's a gap. And because I had my son, again, you know, I was, my immediate postpartum was nowhere near as focused as it was the first time around because I had a toddler to, you know, make sandwiches or, you know, of course I didn't have to do any of that in the first few days, but basically my daughter got 24 hours with her placenta and then we decided that we'd cut it off for safety's sake.
Yeah, goodness me. It's wild living in Australia, all the big, massive pythons as well. And, ooh, yeah, I would be scared of that goanna for sure. I can understand that. So for anyone who doesn't know what a lotus birth is, do you want to explain to them what it means to have a lotus birth?
Yes, it's when you leave the placenta and the umbilical cord attached so that the baby can receive the maximum amount of nutrients available to them from this organ that has grown. It's basically their organ. The premise behind lotus birth is that the placenta is their organ and that it is no longer required once you're out, once the baby is out of the womb. And so, you know, it will dry up and come off at the umbilical cord of the you know, on the baby's belly, but that you can leave it to do that process itself. I was attracted to that idea because I'd read a beautiful book called Lotus Birth by an Australian spiritual midwife called Shiva, Roshana Shivam. That book had just really touched a chord in me of, like, you know, of healing, I think, my own birth. I was born in a hospital and my placenta would have been removed immediately. And so, yeah, I was really drawn to the practice, but I did feel like that I had that moment of healing with my son's lotus birth and with his placenta. And then for my daughter, it was really, you know, within 24 hours, the cord has gone completely white. So all the blood from the placenta has gone into the baby. And I didn't feel the same sort of, you know, healing need to keep it attached. But if you do keep it attached, you know, very often people either salt or use herbs to help the placenta to dry up and to alleviate any smell that comes about. Because depending on your climate, there can be, you know, quite an odor.
Yeah, that book actually is a part of my Sacred Birth Worker Mentorship compulsory book list. I do love that book as well. There's all these different authors in it sharing their views on the placenta. And yeah, it has so many different aspects to it, doesn't it? Lotus birth. It's a very spiritual kind of practice of just like birth without violence, essentially. Birth, you know, being completed by the baby, letting its placenta go in its own time. But it's definitely not for everyone. And some do, just like you, that kind of semi, you know, lotus birth for a while kind of thing. And and everyone, yeah, does it the way it suits them and their families and what feels right to them. But it's nice to speak of. Not everyone obviously does a lotus birth on this podcast, so it's nice when it comes up to explain it for most who might not know what that even is. So you can Google lotus birth and have a little read and maybe listen to
it. A little practical tip that I actually wrote to Roshana about and said, you know, look, if you ever do a reprint of your book, this is a practical concern that isn't addressed in the book, but it, you know, you need to choose a side of the baby's body. Like, oh, I've got the most beautiful thing I can show you.
Oh, yeah.
I just received this beautiful baby in the post. So here we go. We have, so I do a form of birth prep work with birth imprints. So that's why I have a uterine baby. This is the placenta, and it's detachable here on the little button. Just to show you, like, so when the placenta starts drying, you know, if you're wrapping the baby and, you know, you might have nappies on the baby, other clothes, you know, so obviously you need to have clothes that are top and bottom so that there's easy access for you to clean where the umbilical cord is starting to dry up. You know, you might squirt some breast milk on it. That also helps to keep everything clean and is quite drying. But it was my experience. We didn't know. And so we would move the placenta from side to side when we were changing the baby and everything. And it was starting to crack, and then it would heal, and then we would move it, and then it would crack back again. And so my advice and my practical tip is to choose which side of the baby you're going to have the placenta on, so that it all dries in that one direction.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Not just sort of opening and closing the wound all the time.
Mm.
And every baby takes a different period of time for their placenta to separate. And my son's took 5 days. Mm. So it was a full 5 days. And when it happened, he was crying like out of nowhere. He just started crying.
Mm.
And I picked him up and tried to console him and was wondering what's going on. And then I just had this intuition to look at the umbilicus, and it had separated.
Wow.
So then I had a little tear as well, because I was like, we're really done. He's here now. Mm. You know, we've done this birth. Like, you know, it was like the final stage of the birth, and it was beautiful. Yeah. So yeah, that's my practical tip. Choose a side.
Good tip. And what a beautiful story that it made him cry, because that's, I guess, the deep understanding of the practice of lotus birth, is that, you know, the placenta and the umbilical cord, you know, is the same DNA as the baby. And many cultures believe it's like, you know, the baby's twin, or, you know, a guardian angel, or, you know, whatever you want to call it. And it's being compared to like that the little blankie that kids go around, like that protective kind of, or that maybe teddy bear or whatever, that friend, that, and when the baby then gets to spend more time with it than just a minute or two at birth, you know, before it's being cut, you know, it is, when we think about it, that baby is spent its whole life connected to that placenta. It is quite violent to imagine just minutes after birth to be separated from it. That's the only
and it's the source of nurture.
Yes, exactly.
When the baby's in the womb, all the food and all the oxygen is coming through that umbilical cord and placenta. So yeah, to remove it like very rapidly, and you can imagine with no acknowledgement, no telling the baby, like, now we're going to take the placenta away, you know, it doesn't make sense. And it does feel violent.
Yeah, that's really tough.
Yeah, and yeah, I definitely wanted to give my babies the softest, most gentle arrival that I could. I'm just smiling, thinking of my mantra, my sacred mantra, which is probably not very gentle. But
I feel like there's so many women who use swear words as a mantra to bring their babies out, whether it is in transition or whether it is actually, you know, pushing their baby out. I think it's definitely, it has a part in birth.
Yeah.
For some women, that is absolutely it's because it releases energy, you know. We find the thing makes us, it's like almost like, you know, we're holding on to this thing that can carry us through. And if that is, oh my fucking god, then it is, oh my fucking god, that's carrying you through. And it's like releasing something as you're saying it. It's building the strength within you. I believe that.
Mm. And anyway, it is what it is. It was, it did get me through.
It did,
you know. Yeah, but I did with the lotus birth, I did want to really give them the most gentle start possible, and that's why I also chose water birth, because I really strongly felt that whole sort of theory of, you know, from the waters of the womb to the waters of the world, it felt like the most natural thing to do. With my son, he was born in the water. With my daughter, she was born next to the pool.
Yeah, but in the sack. So her entry was covered in water until she came out on land, literally. So.
So if we had a beautiful snuggle in the water, and, you know, eventually the water got sorted after she was born and we had a lovely bath.
Beautiful. You know. So if you had a first-time mama in front of you right now who's about to have her first baby and she really wants to have a natural and empowering birth experience, what advice and pearls of wisdoms would you give to her?
You know, do your inner work. Find the obstacles that are holding you back in life, because some of those are going to be the same in your birth. And, you know, don't shy away from that, because, you know, it's really easy to do that stuff when you've got a baby in your belly. Not so easy when you've got a baby in your arms or a toddler at your feet. And also it really allows you to get to that place of surrender in labor. It makes things move faster because you are able to let go and to release those fears and inhibitions and anything that is making the body contract. And for equal measure that you do your inner work, also connect with your body, because I think in the Western world we're so heady. But having, you know, a somatic relationship with your body is really important when you go into birth. And yeah, there's a reason why my son's birth was 22 hours and my daughter's was 1 hour and 20 minutes. And that piece about connecting with the body is it. In my first pregnancy, I was reading everything. In my second pregnancy, I was just feeling and connecting, you know, in if I had half an hour, get into the body, spiraling, you know, having beautiful love making, you know, like really getting into the body as equally as important as understanding intellectually all the stuff.
Love that. Thank you so much, Nicole, for coming and sharing your beautiful birthing wisdom with us. It's been a pleasure having you.
Thank you. It's lovely to tell the stories.
Thank you for listening. If you love this podcast, then please consider sharing it, leave a review, or make a contribution on our Patreon page. And if you want to connect on social media, then find the podcast on Instagram as The Natural Birth Podcast. Thank you for listening.